From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, closer to the cliff. Chemical weapons warnings over Syria, U.S. unemployment down now 7.7%, and Egypt in uproar. Would the White House watch the country go over the fiscal cliff if Republicans don't bend on higher taxes for top earners? Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, again, we see there's no prospect to an agreement that doesn't involve those rates going up on the top 2% of the wealthiest American members, only 2%.
GOP House Majority Leader Eric Cantor insisted spending is the issue.
We have got to do something about the spending. An obsession to raise taxes is not going to solve the problem.
And in Cairo, huge protests around President Mohamed Morsi. Bloody clashes. Last night, the Egyptian president talked tough.
Although we respect the right of expression, peaceful expression, but I will never allow that anyone should revert to murder and sabotage.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you see at the cliff beyond it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington today, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS. Nancy, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington, Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief at Foreign Policy. Welcome back to you as well, Susan.
Thanks. Good
and
to talk.
Good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Susan.
All right, Nancy, jump straight in here with us. Where are we at the end of this week? Are we closer to the cliff? There's Geithner and the president essentially saying, absolutely, we'll go over if we need to. On the other hand, there's talk of compromise. Where does this thing look like it stands, Nancy?
Well, there are only two people who really know, and that is the president and Speaker Boehner. Secretary Geithner probably has some pretty good insight as well. But this is really a negotiation that's taking place very closely held between the White House and Speaker Boehner's office at this point. You hear a lot of public pronouncements this week about we're talking, we're not talking, negotiations are moving forward, negotiations are stalled. You see a lot of public posturing, but this isn't really related to what's going on behind the scenes. Behind the scenes, this is a very delicate dance where Speaker Boehner knows that the president has a lot of the leverage in this negotiation, but the president needs to give Speaker Boehner enough to be able to bring a majority of his House Republicans along. So trying to find that delicate balance is pretty difficult.
We're going to try and cast our minds behind that screen, if that's possible. I guess everybody's trying. Here was John Boehner on Monday talking about the Republicans' fiscal cliff plan that they had submitted, asked for a White House response. Here's Boehner.
This week we made a good faith offer to avert the fiscal crisis. And that offer included significant spending cuts and reforms, and it included additional revenue. And frankly, it was the balanced approach that the president's been asking for. Now we need a response from the White House. We can't sit here and negotiate with ourselves.
I guess that was Boehner Wednesday after the Republicans put their plan forward on Monday. But Democrats coming right out, Nancy, and saying, hey, you know, we're winning this thing and Republicans are coming over to our side. Here's Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer on that theme.
The House Republican leadership are like generals hunkered away in a bunker who don't realize that their army in the field has already laid down its arms.
Already laid down their arms. Jack Beatty, what do you see going on here?
Well, you know, having just lost the presidential election, the Republicans are for one reason, their brand was damaged. They're further damaging their brand. That's not according to me, but according to Louisiana Republican Governor Bobby Jindal, who this week wrote, any reading of the headlines over the past week indicates that Republicans are fighting to protect the rich and cut benefits for seniors. It may be possible to have worse political positioning than that, but I don't know how, the governor rights. And that is the fact. The polls show overwhelming public support for the president's position and overwhelming readiness on the part of the public to blame the Republicans if we go over the cliff. And then on the other side, the side of the entitlements, a new National Journal poll shows 79% of people want Medicaid left out of the fiscal cliff negotiations, and only 3% want Medicare cut a lot, which by some estimates the Republicans want to do. So the Republicans are, they're in a political bind, and their bind may get worse if we get settle this, because looking ahead, they may get into a situation within a month, within 6 weeks, in which they're basically saying to the president, we won't raise the debt ceiling unless you severely cut entitlements. 79% of the public say don't do that.
Debt ceiling comes right up after this, but let's stay with the cliff for a moment. I mean, Nancy, let's think for a second about this Democratic leverage. You hear Bobby Jindal worrying about it, a lot of Republicans worrying about it. How far does it go? I mean, and is there a point where it gets used so thoroughly that it ends up somehow kicking back on the Democrats? Is it so great that the right. president does not have any incentive to compromise, or is there still an incentive? How do you read the weight and limits of that leverage?
Well, here are his two key pieces of leverage. First of all, polls show, as Jack mentioned, that a majority of Americans agree that it's okay to return the tax rates for the wealthy back to Clinton-era rates. Second, all the Bush tax cuts are set to expire in just a few weeks if Republicans don't capitulate. On the other hand, there is a point where the president starts to look bad if he appears completely unwilling to compromise at all. And a lot of Americans and the markets know that we're getting closer and closer to the fiscal cliff. And this is what caused so much frustration among Republicans this week. They said, look, we put out a proposal. It was a serious proposal. We agreed to $800 billion over 10 years in tax revenue increases. This is a huge step for us. We don't want any tax increases. We're willing to compromise. Where's the willingness to compromise in return? Here's what Democrats said. They say that's smoke and mirrors. You agreed to $800 billion through some vague process of tax reform. You didn't lay out on the table how you would get to that $800 billion number. We need more specifics before we take your offer seriously.
Well, let's look at the dynamics on the Republican side then. Within that camp, I mean, Boehner's got all kinds of pressures he's dealing with, including those saying, don't negotiate too freely here. Don't give it up. We'll talk more about Senator Jim DeMint and where he's headed. But here he was saying that that the Republican leadership risks caving too early, too easily on White House demands. DeMint.
Republicans should not be conceding that the federal government needs more money, negotiating with ourselves, and treating the president's proposal like it's serious. It's time for us to put real proposals on the table, such as the House has passed. We need to stop pretending that we're going to reform entitlements or the tax code in these few weeks before Christmas. We need to extend the current tax rates, and so America will know what their taxes will be next year.
So what's Boehner dealing with? Now, Jim DeMint's going off to a think tank. We'll look at that. But even so, Boehner's got that chorus on the right saying, don't even get into this, John.
There is no tougher job in Washington than Speaker Boehner's right now. On one hand, he's got conservatives like DeMint who are furious that he's even putting tax revenues on the table. They say, look, the president may have won re-election, but Republicans won re-election in the House of Representatives, so why are we giving away the farm? Then he's got more moderate Republicans who are saying, boy, we really should just give in on these tax rates for the top 2%. The wealthy don't care, and we just look bad if we hold out on this. We look like we are only looking out for the rich. So what the speaker needs to do is try to come up with some kind of compromise deal with the president. He knows that he's going to have defections in his party no matter what he agrees to. But he needs to get enough of his conference on board that he still looks like a leader, that he doesn't come out of this damaged. So the question is, how many Republicans is he comfortable losing in a deal? Is he comfortable losing about half? Does he need to lose maybe just a quarter of them? So that's part of this very delicate negotiation. And that's why you don't hear a lot of details out of the White House and the Speaker's office every time the Speaker and the President actually have a conversation. You know, we all beg them to tell us, well, what was it like? Was it cordial? Was it angry?
Forget about it.
They don't say anything because they know that, you know, if they give away any details, it only makes it more difficult for the Speaker to go back to the Republicans in his conference and sell this deal.
Susan Glasser, we're going to get your worldview on this, I promise. But Jack, what about on this front of potential compromise? Do you see elements? Do you see the vague outline of something that could work for both Boehner in his particular, maybe precarious position, and the President in his?
Well, I've heard various possibilities. One is that the Republicans would have two votes in the House. One, the vote to extend all the tax cuts, they would vote for it, and the other vote to extend just the tax cuts for just 98%. And so that they would have been on record as what they want and what they're willing to accept. And if, say, I think 20 Republicans join the Democrats, then the extending the tax cuts for 98%, that could go ahead. Another possibility I've heard is that to save the Speaker's face and perhaps even have some grounds for some more comprehensive amity, the President would agree to tax reform. You know, we'll raise the rates for the 2% now, tax reform next year, and perhaps some of those rates can come down as a result of tax reform. Boehner can go to his people and say, we have what we want. We've got a commitment to tax reform that could lower rates back down.
Susan Glasser, the whole world is watching. Does it look like an America that's got its game here going on or not?
Well, I think people are pretty befuddled. We just had a great dispatch posted on our site from an Asia hand who's been fielding befuddled phone calls and emails from folks in Japan and China and Australia saying, do you have a suicide wish among your politicians?
Cliff chasm apocalypse. What have you got going on there, USA? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, sound right there, of one very big story in Cairo, Egypt. Supporters and opponents of Egypt's President Mohamed Morsi clashing outside the presidential palace in Cairo. We will come to that with Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, who joins us today from Washington. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Jack Beatty's here. Nancy, Susan, Jack, let's hear from our listeners. Ivana in Saranac Lake, New York. Thanks for calling, Ivana. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom. Yes, I believe we have to stop this political posturing. They don't care, you know, these politicians don't care about the people getting hurt or the future generations that are going to be stuck paying these huge debts. And the Bush tax cuts, they were never meant to be permanent. When they came into law, they were supposed to expire. So, you know, I'd be fine with letting them expire. And by the way, when they first did them and you were supposed to get that tax deduction, I'm a pretty low income. I do work.
Yeah.
But I'm a pretty low income person.
Yes.
And I didn't get any tax cut.
It didn't feel like it to you. Ivana, we've got it. You know, Nancy, Ivana raises an interesting point that in the Bush tax cut, there was an expiration date right there. But mm-hmm. Oh, how the winds change in Washington. I mean, when that was done, as I recall it, the pretty deep and full presumption was nobody will be able to stop this. They'll go right forward. And so we don't have to count them in the long-term budget numbers because they're temporary, but no one would dare to turn this around. And here we are. It looks like it's probably going to turn around.
That's right. I mean, the president has tried before and failed to let the tax rates expire, at least for the upper incomes. And he has run into a Republican buzzsaw. You know, it's only because he has won re-election and the Democrats have won some seats that they're sort of feeling like they can really stand their ground on this, especially since the president campaigned so hard on this very issue. But here's something to keep in mind, Ivana, mm-hmm. that might make you feel a little better, which is that, you know, for all we know, the president and the speaker are extremely close to a deal or really know what the outlines of a deal are. But even if they did, they wouldn't tell us until the last minute. They're going to leave us all in the lurch. And that's because Republicans, I mean, not raising taxes is really, you know, a central part of their platform. They can't appear to give away the store too easily. They're going to have to wait until the very last minute and look as if they went kicking and screaming to a compromise that raises tax revenue or raises tax rates. And that's why, even if the negotiations were going well, we wouldn't see any kind of announcement of a deal until very close to January 1st.
And, of course, there's that dynamic. No deal. All the taxes go up, and lots of Republicans worried about that. Ben in West Hartford, Connecticut. Ben, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have a very quick comment that I would like to make. I feel almost exactly like your last caller, that it's a lot of posturing and, you know, no real feeling about the people from the congressmen and senators that are working this.
So where are you? And where's your worry, Ben? Are you worried that recession will come if we go over this cliff and that people will pay a price economically, or where's your concern?
Mostly my concern is just the lack of concern of people, of the people by Congress. The one quick comment I wanted to make was that I absolutely believe that if the consequence of not having a deal was not, you know, dramatic tax increases and spending cuts, but that the congressmen and senators that were involved lost their jobs and were ousted from Congress, we would have a deal.
Right, put their jobs on the line, not the rest of the country. Well, remember well, Ben, I mean, the polls will come around again, though it's interesting how that fear or not fear plays out. Let me get one more. Charlie, Murrells Inlet, South Carolina. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a very interesting subject. I believe the going over the cliff might be beneficial in the long run. And the only reason I don't think we're going to go over the cliff, perhaps, is because I think Obama is going to be strong enough to stick to his guns. Then if it does go over the cliff, it will be easier for Obama to get his way because of the public backlash against the Republicans, especially regarding the tax increase for the rich, which Obama campaigned successfully on.
So it looks like he's in the catbird seat to you. Maybe either way. Charlie, I appreciate your call. Hey, Charlie, you're in South Carolina. What about Jim DeMint going? He's your U.S. senator. He's leaving after, you know, before his term is up. What do you think about that?
I've only been here 4 weeks.
Oh.
I don't know. I don't know too much to make an opinion or judgment on that.
A sage position. We are a wonderfully mobile country. But thanks for your call, Charlie. You know, there's the president and there's the fiscal cliff. But Jack, you raised earlier the debt ceiling, which is going to have to be raised. What is it, in February? That's coming up just after the first of the year, and we know how that's been used for leverage, specifically by the GOP in 2011, very vividly. The president's thinking a lot about this. Here he was on Wednesday saying, when we get to that cliff or chasm or abyss, whatever you want to call it, he will not negotiate under the gun of the debt ceiling. Here he is.
I want to send a very clear message to people here. We are not going to play that game next year. If Congress in any way suggests that they're going to tie negotiations to debt ceiling votes and take us to the brink of default once again as part of a budget negotiation, which, by the way, we have never done in our history until we did it last year, I will not play that game, because we've got to break that habit before it starts.
I will not play that game, says the president of the United States to the Congress, effectively, to Republicans there. Nancy Cordes, can he bow out of that game somehow? I mean, last time he didn't seem to find any way out. The Republicans threatened to, you know, let the country just go, and the president scarcely ignored it last time.
Mm-hmm. He can certainly try, and he does have some ground to stand on, because obviously what happened as a result of that game last time around is that we saw our credit rating drop, and we saw that Republicans were blamed for that more than Democrats. That's part of the reason why Democrats made some gains in these past elections.
And that pushes up our borrowing costs, the interest rates we pay. That cost us real money when that rate changed.
That's right. On the other hand, you have some Republicans saying, look, you know, you can't do this to us again. You can't win, you know, as it looks like the president will, this negotiation with us over the fiscal cliff and then take it to us again on the debt ceiling. You're going to have to give us something. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that at the end of the day, Republicans will get something in exchange for raising that debt ceiling.
So who's really got the leverage here, Jack? If the president has it, you know, for January 1st, but the Republicans have it conceivably in February, where's the power, Jack?
Well, they, if they think they have the power, perhaps they should think again, because this would be a catastrophe if, in fact, the president stuck to his position and they stuck to theirs and we defaulted. That would be a historic catastrophe, and the Republicans would almost certainly be blamed more than the president. So it's a sword they don't want to wield, really, it seems to me. But let's just go play out the scenario. I mean, the president said, I won't yield. Does that mean he would raise the debt ceiling on his own authority using some people think spurious authority in the 14th Amendment?
Bill Clinton may think that. He's made muttered
along
those lines.
And yesterday the New York Times said he may have to think of that. Well, if he does that set up an impeachment proceeding in the House? Right. I mean,
has completely ruled that out. And this week they were asked about that and they said, no, we're not going to resort to that, even though some Democrats in the Senate think they should.
Well, there is the 14th Amendment. I mean, doesn't it say right there, I don't have the language in front of me, but nobody will walk away from American debt. It's inviolable. Worse to that effect, Nancy. Isn't that, I mean, if nothing happens, doesn't that amendment come into play here?
Right. Well, you know, the White House has been tempted to take this route before, and they always stayed away from it. So I think it is really a last resort. And it's possible that the debt ceiling could end up just getting rolled into this whole fiscal cliff negotiation, so we don't have to have yet another negotiation as soon as Congress comes back from the winter break. So it's all very fluid right now.
Oh, wow. Incredible. Richard, East Killingly, Connecticut. Richard, thanks for calling.
Yes. My thinking is that one of the big issues that isn't being talked about is the exclusion before the Bush tax cuts. It's $2 million for inheritance tax, and I suspect that's being negotiated. There are people in 2010 who made $6 billion. They have an incredible estate that would ultimately be taxed everything over $2 million at about a 54%. So somewhere in the background, you have people whose estates will be taxed.
Right, big money estates.
The money they stole will be clawed back, frankly.
Yeah, working the organ pedals here. I don't know, Nancy, how many things are really on the table in this. I mean, do you think that there's that big a backroom negotiation? Of course, estate taxes are part of this. They
right.
change as well on January 1st. I guess it would be everything. But if Obama and Boehner are doing that, how are they even doing it? I mean, they barely publicly speak to each other that we know of, or is there some big, you know, poker table in the middle of the night that we don't know about?
Well, they've got a lot of staffers who are sending proposals back and forth, and this estate tax definitely is part of the discussions. Whether it will end up in the final negotiation, we don't know. But there are all kinds of things that are on the table. There's raising the Medicare eligibility age from 65 to 67. That's something that Republicans have proposed. There's Medicaid changes. Republicans would like to see some changes to Social Security. So there are all kinds of policies that are in the mix right now, and there's going to be a lot of give and take, so it's hard to say right now what's going to end up in the final package.
And I know we've just got you for a couple more minutes, Nancy. Talk to us about Jim DeMint. I mean, this huge figure in the right wing of the Republican Party, the Tea Party wing, and here he is after a couple of years of this term. He's going to leave to run the conservative think tank in Washington, the Heritage Foundation. Here, we'll listen to him for just a second. I want to get your read on this. Here's Jim DeMint.
I wouldn't feel good about leaving if we didn't have so many new, bright young conservatives now in the Senate. But it's time that conservatives take control of our message and let Americans know what we can do to make their lives better. Republicans hadn't done that good a job as a party doing that, so we need to take the control of the message ourselves.
What is going on here, Nancy? I know there's a big pay difference between the Senate and the million-dollar salary of the Heritage Foundation chief, but what's this about?
I think it's about a few different things. I mean, first of all, this came as a big surprise on Capitol Hill. Nobody saw this coming. He's right in the middle of his second term. He had always said that he would leave at the end of his second term. I suspect that this job came open. It's open now. It probably won't be open in a couple of years. As you noted, it's a very well-paying job. The current president of the Heritage Foundation made more than $1 million in 2010, according to tax records, and the average U.S. senator makes about $174,000 a year. So, yes, do the math. Is he quadrupling his salary? But also, you know, he's had a challenging relationship with his own party on Capitol Hill. In one sense, he's been this Tea Party kingmaker. He's been responsible for helping to bring very powerful Tea Party new senators like Marco Rubio, like Rand Paul, like Mike Lee of Utah into the Senate. He was an early supporter. On the other hand, he backed a number of far-right candidates, some would say very weak candidates, who ended up winning surprise victories in their primaries only to get slaughtered in the general election. And some Republicans feel that were it not for the efforts of Jim DeMint, they might control the Senate right now, because he backed candidates like Christine O'Donnell of Delaware, who you remember had to air that ad saying she's not a witch. Right. He backed Sharon Angle of Nevada, who lost to the majority leader, Harry Reid, folks like that. So I think that he felt that he could continue to back the kind of candidates he wants at the Heritage Foundation. He'll be free to raise a lot of money. He's already a pretty good fundraiser. He'll be able to raise even more. And he'll have this megaphone that he wants to push very conservative causes. As he likes to say, the bigger government gets, the smaller God gets.
Oh, okay. There's one kind of fraction or ratio. Jack, what do you see in this for the Tea Party? Up, down, sideways, or is it just a pay raise issue?
Well, you know, there are other signs about the Tea Party. Dick Armey, you know, at Americans for Prosperity, is leaving. He's leaving with an $8 million exit bonus. And four GOP House members who were Tea Party people who'd given Speaker Boehner trouble in their term, they have been demoted, and people are taking that as an example of we're putting you in your place. You know, DeMint is such an emblematic figure. He's a man of integrity. You have to say that. He voted against an Army Corps of Engineers study to deepen the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina, so the Charleston
his own backyard.
Yeah, Charleston could bid on the new traffic opened by the widening of the Panama Canal. He voted against a study even to look at that. Now, you could say that is a man of integrity. On the other hand, you could look at Spiegel, the German magazine, which just wrote, quote, "The hatred of big government has reached a level in the United States that threatens the country's very existence." I mean, you know. There's the range.
Yeah. Well, let's get Tom in Columbia, South Carolina on here on the Jim DeMint front, if we can. Tom in Columbia, thanks for calling. You are on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
It's to the DeMint issue. The front runner right now is allegedly Scott, who's a Charleston congressman.
To replace him, take his seat. Mm-hmm.
To replace him. This will occur after the Cliff hangover, and if it goes bad, if Scott does come in, that may turn that whole district into almost a national race for Congress, where outside money coming in to replace Scott, who's now a Tea Partier. Also, the other thing, Scott or whoever replaces DeMint would have to run again in a special election in 14 when we have Nikki Haley running for governor.
Your governor.
And Lindsey Graham.
Yes.
So it's going to be fireworks come 2014. This could maybe be an opening for the Democrats in the sense in this state.
I haven't looked at the numbers, but I'll take your word for it right there in Columbia, Tom, and I appreciate your call very much. Nancy, I know we got to let you go in just a second here. We're going to get to Syria and Egypt and a lot more with Susan. But President Obama this week, the big talk on chemical weapons in Syria. If you go there, you're in trouble. Bluster or a real threat? What's the sense on the Hill?
Well, this is a pretty tricky path for the White House to navigate, and I think you see members of Congress really trying to give the White House wide berth right now. The challenge for them is that they want to appear to talk tough to Assad, but they can't really make any specific threats when it comes to chemical weapons unless they're willing to back it up with military intervention. And there's a real reluctance right now to get involved in yet another Middle East conflict.
We'll come back and look at that with Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine. It sure sounded like it was getting pretty close to specific threats with the president this week. Nancy Cordes with CBS News, congressional correspondent there. Thanks so much for being with us, Nancy.
Sure thing. Glad to do it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, more soul-searching in the NFL after the murder-suicide case of Kansas City Chiefs linebacker Jovan Belcher. Here's his mother, Cheryl Shepherd, with her 911 call after he shot his girlfriend, Cassandra Perkins.
Just don't leave him, but Billy, please hurry. I don't know how many times he got her. They were arguing.
Okay, so she's been shot?
Yes, she was, and died. Baby fever in Great Britain after news of Kate Middleton's royal pregnancy. An Australian radio host called her hospital, talked to a nurse there, pretending to be the Queen.
Kate, my darling, are you there?
Good morning, Mum. This is the nurse speaking. How may I help you?
Hello, I'm just after my granddaughter, Kate. I want to see how her little tummy bug is going.
And we remember this week jazz legend Dave Brubeck, dead at nearly 92. Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine joins us. Jack Beattie is here, and you can join us as well. What do you make of the White House warning to Syria on chemical weapons this week? What would we, should we do if they were used? What do you make of Israel's announcement of new settlement plans, of everything that's going on in Egypt? And, of course, we're also watching those legislative moves in Michigan to make it a right-to-work state. Will labor unions be broken in Michigan, of all places? Jack, Susan, you know, everybody's been kind of having a little laugh this week about the hoax on Kate Middleton in the hospital. But I am just reading wire stories coming in here saying that the nurse who took that call at the King Edward VII Hospital in London has died, has been found dead. So that's all the detail I have at this moment, but I let us hope that I, well, died of shame. I don't know what, but that's, you know, we make our jokes, but you know, people's lives sometimes ride on their sense of themselves in the world. And I don't know what happened there, but the nurse who took that call from the Australian radio hosts yucking it up between Australia and London, reportedly here, the wire's coming out, dead today. I want to turn to that Syrian story. Here on Wednesday, the Assad regime's warplanes were bombing suburbs of Damascus as rebels tried to push their way into the center of the capital city of Syria. Getting more and more serious, as if it hasn't been there already for some time. On Monday at the National Defense University, President Obama said that any use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government was a red line not to be crossed.
And today I want to make it absolutely clear to Assad and those under his command, the world is watching. The use of chemical weapons is and would be totally unacceptable. And if you make the tragic mistake of using these weapons, there will be consequences and you will be held accountable.
Susan Glasser, what is going on here with this very hot, explicit warning from Washington directed at the Assad regime over chemical weapons? What's it about?
Well, you know, it's actually not the first warning from Washington on the subject of chemical weapons, and it's not the first time that President Obama has even called it a red line. In fact, what's quite interesting is that actually he's now moved back his red line. And the last time he said this was an absolute red line and that beware because the United States was finally going to do something on Syria, he said the word moving, if they were moving chemical weapons. This week, that's disappeared from his threats along with those of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And I think, unfortunately, what you see is that the United States is, as one unnamed official told the New York Times, in a box here. And I think more than 30,000 people are dead. So it's not that the situation is getting serious. It's been terribly serious for almost 2 years now. And yet, at the same time, the United States is actually no closer to military action because they haven't found a way where they can intervene and understand what is a successful day after that sort of a military intervention look like. That being said, I think the alarm is very serious when it comes to the chemical weapons stockpile, not necessarily because they believe that Assad is going to be using these imminently on his own people, although, of course, that is a possibility as he becomes more and more concerned about his own personal survival, that is Assad. But potentially the concern is what happens after Assad falls. Is there the possibility of proliferation? There's an increasing number of jihadist groups active in Syria today in the opposition. We're not clear really what the makeup of those groups is. There's the possibility of those weapons falling into the hands of people that we don't want them to have.
Whether it's chemical weapons or reports of shoulder-fired weapons now bringing down Assad regime aircraft and where those could end up as well, all kinds of concerns on the other side of whatever the end game may be here. Chris in Grafton, Massachusetts is calling. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wonder if anybody remembers 1990, at the beginning of the Gulf War, Poppy Bush contacted Saddam Hussein and said, I want you to know that I consider the use of all weapons of mass destruction to be equivalent. Now, specifically, if you use chemical or biological weapons against our troops or coalition troops, I will use nuclear weapons against you. And in fact, he said, I won't use it against Baghdad. I would bomb your hometown of Tikrit. And that was considered a factor in Saddam not using those weapons.
So what are you're feeling like maybe this is a prelude to U.S. intervention? Can you picture what that would look like, Chris?
I think that if Bush had crossed that line, there would have been enormous repercussions. But I think the warning probably caused Saddam at that time to desist. I don't know if Obama would dare to make such a suggestion today.
Jack, you remember that history, of course. Different country, different president, different time. But here we've got President Obama again, as Susan Glasser says, and with slightly different language, maybe moving the red line back, but it sure sounded hot. How do you read what's coming out of Washington on this, looking at Syria, Jack?
Well, that 1990 precedent cuts a little sort of both ways. I mean, it was, yes, they didn't use the poison gas against our troops, but he did use it against Shiites in the south, and we did nothing about that. So, for reasons really like the ones that paralyze the government today, really. You know, I have seen military experts say we can't do anything to the bases. They're on the Jordanian border. If you bomb these bases where they keep these weapons, just put sarin gas in the air, and you can't do that. But what you can do is essentially threaten decapitation. That the presidential palace, that's the kind of signal being sent that we're going to. It's similar to the warning about Tikrit. We're going to go right where you live if you do this. I don't know whether that's on or not.
I mean, just as you say, already a terrible death toll here. So much suffering. We're hearing all about the refugees. NPR's Deborah Amos will join us on Monday to look at that and more right from the Syrian front there. But do you see something changing here? I mean, we've got NATO with what they're sending, the Patriot missiles to the Turkish border with Syria. We've got reports that Hillary Clinton is meeting, I guess, right now with the Russian foreign minister, Sergey Lavrov. Do you see something being woven around this to find a solution, or are we still on a fight to some bloody unforeseeable end path, Susan?
Well, both things may well be true. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's happening is that the international diplomatic effort has stepped up in response to what appear to be a fairly significant number of military gains on the part of the rebels against Assad over the last month, really at a time when our attention has been focused elsewhere. They have closed in on Damascus and put significantly more pressure on the regime. And so I think what you're seeing is a stepped up diplomatic initiative that reflects that. And it is interesting that Lavrov and Clinton are meeting today, brokered by the UN envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. They are, quote unquote, brainstorming about solutions, which is certainly something different than we've seen in terms of the Russians' willingness to engage in dialogue with the United States about the future of Assad, which up till now they have refused categorically to even put that on the table. And the proposals that they've made, which have all been rejected by the U.S. and other Western allies, have explicitly insisted upon not talking about regime change. So there does seem to be some sort of movement there. Next week, there's a big meeting in Morocco at which it's expected that the United States might take the step which France and others have taken of recognizing the Syrian coalition of opposition as the official representatives of the Syrian people. That would be a diplomatic step forward. It would enable additional aid to flow to them, as well as the beginnings of a post-Assad political process. But at the same time, it's not entirely clear how connected up this political opposition is to the people who are actually on the ground fighting. And as many people here in Washington believe, at this point, every day that goes forward of the fighting is a day that potentially benefits the radical jihadist elements who are on the ground doing the hard work of killing and dying in their efforts to oust Assad.
We're going to look in more depth and up close on Monday at Syria with NPR's Deborah Amos. I want to turn to Egypt, if we may. Huge demonstrations there, fighting there this week in the streets. Very big numbers, a death toll, many, many injured. Here's an interview on Wednesday. This is with AFP. One Egyptian saying he was protesting in front of the presidential palace to counter the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egyptian politics.
I'm here to deliver a message to the president. Egypt for all Egyptians, not for one particular faction.
Susan, what is going on in Egypt at this point? Of course, Morsi took all these powers, but this week kind of open, warfare is the wrong word, but this was big fighting. I'm reading here 6 dead, hundreds and hundreds wounded. This is breaking wide open.
Well, I think you're seeing a major cataclysm among the fragile Egyptian political structure that has emerged in the nearly 2 years since the Tahrir Square revolution. It's all coming to a head around basically two things. One is the very contentious process of writing a new constitution in Egypt and headed looking towards a December 15th referendum on that. It is the constitution has been written largely by the Islamist-dominated parliament, and so you're seeing an increasing concern and fear on the part of those who don't support the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists that is the constitution they're going to be saddled with. And related to that is what appears to have been a major power grab by Morsi, in which he did not seem to anticipate the consequences and putting people back in the streets by saying, in effect, I'm the law between now and when we get a new constitution, and I refuse to abide by any decrees of the judiciary. So there are many across the political spectrum in Egypt who are basically concerned that he's simply set himself up as an Islamist, a Muslim Brotherhood version of Hosni Mubarak.
Do you see reason to not agree with them?
Well, I think that clearly what you have is a president who is feeling his power, who is aggressively determined to use that power. When you had the specter of protesters coming out in front of the presidential palace the other day, and you had not only the military deploying tanks on Morsi's behalf, but you had the Muslim Brotherhood putting their own people in the streets, basically a bloody, messy, horrible street fight ensued. Hundreds were wounded, several dead. So it just looks like political gridlock.
And then let's turn to Israel, if we may. On Monday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu there digging in on his plan to build 3,000 more housing units in areas of East Jerusalem, contested areas there, and in the West Bank, this very contentious area known as E1. There was all kinds of complaint out of Europe. I guess the United States behind the scenes. We'll ask you about that, Susan. But here, this was the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, who normally is pretty supportive, saying that Germany and Israel are going to agree to disagree about this round of Israeli settlements. Here she is speaking with translation.
We want the Jewish state of Israel to exist and a Palestinian state. To achieve that, we need negotiations and to avoid unilateral measures. As far as settlements go, we agree to disagree.
And here's the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu at that Berlin press conference saying freezing the building of settlements in the West Bank would not end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Netanyahu.
Most Europeans believe that the issue, the root cause of our conflict with the Palestinians is the settlements. The settlements issue is one that has to be resolved in negotiations. But it is not the root cause of our conflict, because this conflict was waged from the areas adjacent to Israel for 50 years before there was a single settlement.
Susan, first, how hard did the United States try to stop Israel from announcing this movement of new settlements into this very tough area? Many people saying that if these go ahead, there is no path to a two-state solution because the West Bank is just chopped up too much. Did Washington push back hard before this became public? Do we know?
Well, it's a good question. I think the important date to keep in mind here is January 22nd, which is Israel's upcoming election. And in many ways, my sense and in the sense of people who know a lot more about Israel than I do is that Netanyahu is really playing to a domestic audience here. I don't think he feels that the Europeans have been particularly supportive up to this point. This was an unusually public rupture with them, but certainly an indication of where the European public opinion has been for quite some time. What Netanyahu is doing is playing to his own core base, looking ahead to the election. And remember that they've just come out of this short, sharp Gaza war right after the U.S. election. And I think it played very differently here in the United States and Europe than it did at home in Israel, where if you read the coverage, if you talk to the commentators, there was a sense almost incredibly to those of us outside of this situation that perhaps Netanyahu had ended the war too early had he not captured advantage. Any time that the bombs fly and yet the Hamas government remains intact, they're going to claim that as a victory. And so I think there's a concern for Netanyahu to shore up his right flank here. So that's somewhat of what's going on. But for Obama,
in Israeli politics. But I mean, we're reading that Washington, that the White House did make a concerted effort to try to have Israel not do this. And this is just days after the U.S. stood, you know, with a very small number with Israel in the U.N. And then Israel turns around. I mean, Jack, this is quite a picture. If this really means cutting off the possibility of a two-state solution, which so many American administrations and many Israelis have worked for before this time, that's some dynamic, Jack.
It is. Now, it's a second term, and the conventional wisdom is that presidents in their second term have more leverage to put pressure on Israel. That doesn't seem to have happened, at least successfully. You know, Tom Friedman this week, reporting from Israel, used the image of the Iron Dome and the wall. And he says that between the two of these things, the Iron Dome, the missiles, the defensive missiles that knock down the missiles from Gaza, the wall, which cuts off the West Bank from Israel proper, it's made the Israelis think we don't have to worry about the Palestinians anymore. One settler leader on the West Bank told them, our biggest problem, traffic jams.
Well, it doesn't look like it's all going to be wrapped up that easily. I'm sure, I don't know if this is over or not, but it's a big step, and we will see how this one unfolds. CNN and The Guardian now reporting that nurse in London who was involved in the hoax with Kate and her pregnancy may have committed suicide. We'll continue to watch that. Boy, we make jokes and the world turns. Susan Glasser, Editor-in-Chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you very much for being with us this hour, Susan.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, thanks for joining us today, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, take care. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.